plank, past lines of trees heavy with spring foliage, around the walking ring, then toward the barns. A cluster of people trailed him. Seabiscuit, wired from the journey, was bucking and kicking out behind, so they kept their distance. On the backstretch, the horse passed War Admiral's barn. On the wall near the Triple Crown winner's stall was a little shrine to Manowar and Brushup, War Admiral's mother. Below photos of the two horses hung a sign, "They gave us War Admiral." War Admiral's trainer, George Conway, lingered by his horse's stall. He was a tall, cardiganed old man, formal and quiet. He hovered over the grooms while they curried his horse and prowled along behind when the horse went to the track. War Admiral stood quietly as Seabiscuit clopped past. The two horses didn't see each other. Seabiscuit moved on to Barn 43, to a freshly painted 168-square-foot stall with a cathedral ceiling. Howard had obtained special permission to knock down the wall between it and the next stall so that Pumpkin could take up his customary sidekick position. On April 28th, Pollard completed his long drive across the country. He went to the barns to see Seabiscuit, then hung up his tack. Wolf was there with him. Howard had insisted that Pollard ride in the match, but he was covering his bases. Wolf's presence was a constant reminder of Pollard's shaky position. He needed no reminding. The papers were full of questions about Pollard's ability and fitness. The newsmen gathered by the rails, watched Pollard ride, and commented on his obvious soreness. They began to wonder aloud what Howard was thinking. "It's probably a matter of sentiment with owner Howard to put Pollard in the pilot house, and it might turn out to be a good idea despite," wrote reporter Jack James. "But right now it looks, from this distance, as just another worst of an impost which our boyfriend, the Biscuit, must carry to the post." The moment Pollard arrived at the track, the hard training began. Because the starting gates of the day had no doors, the only braking signal horses received was the ring of a bell. Smith wanted to sharpen Seabiscuit's response to it. He began by fashioning a homemade starting bell. He boosted Pollard onto Seabiscuit, picked up the starting bell and a buggy whip, and without a word of explanation, led them to the training track. Pollard must have expected that they would go to the gate, but Smith led them right past it. The jockey had learned enough to know that asking Smith what was going on would have been fruitless. He rode out to the track in silence, looking down at the contraption clutched in Smith's hand and wondering at the trainer's judgment. "I thought Tom," he remembered later, "had blown his topper." Smith positioned Pollard and Seabiscuit on the track, then moved a few feet behind them. Pollard prepared himself for Smith's orders. Smith lifted the buggy whip and flicked it over Seabiscuit's flanks just as he hit the bell. The device raised a clanging racket, sounding, Pollard remembered later, like all hell breaking loose. The jockey burst into frantic urging, and Seabiscuit lunged forward, breaking into a dead run. Pollard galloped Seabiscuit out, brought him back, and he and Smith repeated the drill over and over. The lesson was perfectly conceived classical conditioning. Seabiscuit, like any prey animal, was hardwired to bound forward at the whip's brush over his hindquarters, a simulation of a predator's grasp. By pairing the touch of the whip with the sound of the bell, Smith was teaching Seabiscuit to associate one with the other so that he would have the same reaction to the first as to the second. Run. Seabiscuit proved to be a superb student. After a few tries, he was reacting so quickly that he was gone before Smith could wave the whip. The horse was alert, buoyant, animated, all of his faculties alive to his rider. Pollard could feel it under him, electricity pulsing up into his hands. The jockey, too, needed a little conditioning. To prepare Pollard for a rocket start, Smith sent him out for races on every front-running sprinter in the Howard barn. Smith didn't care about the race results. All he wanted was swift starts and the fastest early fractions. The horses lost, but Pollard did as told, outbreaking the field in each race. His arm was loosening up every day, and for the first time since his fall with Fahrenheitis, he began to look like the rider he had once been. Seeing Pollard coming back into form, Smith changed training tactics. He took the rider and Seabiscuit out to the starting gate. Traditional gait schooling has always been a matter of standing still, teaching a horse to tolerate the huge, clattering metal contraption around him while he awaits the loading of other horses. But in the match race, War Admiral would be his only competitor. Waiting would not be a problem. If Seabiscuit relaxed in the gait, War Admiral would leave him in his dust. The horse had to learn to be less patient, not more. Smith designed a new exercise. Sitting on Pumpkin by the gate, he ordered Pollard to rush Seabiscuit into the gate, pause for only an instant, then gallop out. Pollard did as told, and Seabiscuit bounded through. After a few repetitions, Seabiscuit grew playful. He eagerly dove into the gate and streaked right through, then pivoted back for another run at it. After a dozen or so starts, the horse was bouncing all over the track. It was time for a test. Starter George Cassidy stepped into the starter's box, and Smith brought Seabiscuit up. This time, Pollard halted him in the gate. For a moment, Seabiscuit stood still, perched on his toes, hind legs braced, ready to roll. Cassidy rang the bell. Pollard threw the reins up on Seabiscuit's neck, and the two sprang out. Seabiscuit ran flat out for a 1/16 of a mile before Pollard pulled him up. Smith was satisfied that the horse understood the task before him. Seabiscuit skipped back to the barn. "Obviously," said one railbird, in a marvelous humor. On May 11th, Smith began the third phase of starting gate instruction. For horses, herd animals alert to clues of danger from each other, skittishness is contagious. War Admiral was a raging lion behind the gate, and Smith was concerned that Seabiscuit would take one look at his opponent's tantrum and throw one of his own. He needed to expose Seabiscuit to a similarly unruly gate horse and inure him to the sight of it. He already had just the right horse for the job. Months earlier, Howard had purchased a colt named Chanceview from Alfred Vanderbilt. The horse had proved fairly useful as a stakes horse, but he was an incorrigible rogue at the starting gate. Smith brought them out together, turned Seabiscuit toward Chanceview, and let him watch while the colt banged around like a rodeo bronc. Smith drilled them in the gate until he was satisfied that Seabiscuit had seen every trick War Admiral might pull. The New York publicity machine heated up. On May 4th, Seabiscuit and War Admiral were brought out on a grassy lawn before a pink flowering hedge to pose for an army of photographers. War Admiral emerged first. He was a splendid sight, his mane and tail braided in yellow ribbons, his coat glossy and his head high. He was in a mercurial Hastings temper, and a halter and chain looped over his bridle barely restrained him. As an attendant approached him with the saddle, he reared skyward, struck out with his forelegs, and began plunging around on the end of his lead. The saddle holder chased him around and around the enclosure. The man threw the saddle over the horse's back, and War Admiral flung it right off. They tossed it on him again, only to have it come sailing back in their faces. "Don't worry about that," said his nervous jockey, Charlie Kurtzinger. "As soon as he starts running, he's the easiest horse in the world to handle. All he wants is to get out in front and go." Finally, they got the saddle on and the girth cinched. Kurtzinger, dapper in Riddle's legendary black and yellow silks, leapt onto his back, and again War Admiral flung himself around, bucking and thrashing and tearing divots out of the Belmont lawn. Kurtzinger gritted his teeth and hung on. The photographers began grumbling. "He's just a lively horse," Trainer Conway said weakly as he was buffeted around. A distant train whistle sounded. War Admiral spooked at it, jerking his head up. For one brief instant he stood still, ears pricked, head high, body stretched out in all its geometric magnificence. He was listening to the train. No one was foolish enough to try to pull off the ugly halter and nose chain to perfect the shot. The attendant on the end of the lead rope braced himself. Kurtzinger turned his head and grinned stiffly, and all the photographers snapped their shots. Kurtzinger bailed out and War Admiral whirled off. Seabiscuit came out after him, sauntering in, wrote a reporter, like he owned the place. Pollard strode out with him, buttoned into Howard's red and white silks. The contrast between the two horses could not have been more glaring. Though a little lower at the withers and nearly half a foot shorter, nose to tail, Seabiscuit seemed a cumbersome giant in comparison. At 1,040 pounds, he outweighed War Admiral by 80 pounds, with 6 feet of girth and a markedly wider chest. But the big body was perched on legs a full 2 inches shorter. His neck was thick, his head heavy, his tail stubby, his boxing glove knees crouched. Whitey had done his best to clean Seabiscuit up, braiding his mane, forelock, and tail, but the mane plates didn't lie right and stuck out like quills. The horse stood straddle-legged, as if perpetually bracing himself against a strong wind. But to the weary photographers, Seabiscuit was a relief. He stood perfectly still as he was being saddled, and Pollard hopped on his back. The photographers lifted their cameras, and Seabiscuit pricked his ears and struck his horizon-gazing pose. He held the position, without quivering a muscle, for nearly 5 minutes as the photographers scurried around him, cameras grinding, shooting him from every angle. They brought the noisy newsreels right up to his nose, but he never moved. From the day of his arrival in New York, Smith was Smith. The New York press corps couldn't get a grunt out of him. "Tom Smith," wrote a reporter, "says almost nothing, constantly." The New York Herald Tribune found one reporter's valiant attempt to get more than a monosyllabic answer out of him so amusing that it published a transcript of the entire non-conversation. Smith was cooperative in only one respect. Probably at Howard's insistence, he let the press come into the barn to see the horse, albeit without narration from the trainer. This was a step better than George Conway. A similarly mute man described by one reporter as lean, tall, and indifferent. Conway wouldn't let photographers near the barn in the understandable fear that the jittery war admiral would spook at the flashbulbs and whack his head. When Smith proved more welcoming, the reporters virtually moved into Barn 43, forcing the trainer to wade through them to get to his horse. When the horse left the barn, they tramped along en masse behind him, joining large throngs of spectators on the apron of the track. They hung around day and night, asking Smith if he really thought his horse could win. By May 14th, the honeymoon was over. "You won't be seeing this horse much anymore," Smith growled. He shooed the press out of the barn, slung a rope across the entrance, posted a guard, and retreated to his track cottage, sitting by an oil stove in a cramped room. Even Pollard, who had been jabbering gaily with reporters since his arrival, stopped talking. "Some suspect," wrote Jolly Roger, "that Tom may have removed his tongue." Team Seabiscuit effectively vanished. No one was allowed to see the horse. "Please for information" brought a vintage reply. "No." The reporters assumed that Smith was just being curmudgeonly, but there was likely more to it than that. In a workout 3 days earlier, Seabiscuit had needed 1 minute and 48 seconds to negotiate a mile. Though the track was somewhat soggy that day, Seabiscuit had been capable of ticking off miles in a minute and 36 seconds throughout his career with Smith. It had been an unusually rainy spring in New York, and the track was difficult to handle even when dry. But the surface alone couldn't account for so sluggish a workout. The horse seemed off, yet Smith could find no problem. There was still plenty of time before the race, but the trainer was increasingly concerned. He knew that any sign that Seabiscuit was not himself would only make the press more intrusive. He parked himself in the cottage and kept his mouth shut. More than ever before, he sought to hide the horse's training, taking him out at 4 a.m. He got away with it until one morning when he was a little late leading the horse off the track. A group of clockers arriving for work at 4:30 saw Smith leading a winded Seabiscuit back to the barn. Smith moved the work times to 8 p.m. For the time being, no one caught him, but the press now knew he was fooling them. The absence of news about the year's biggest story drove the reporters to distraction. At first they wrote whatever came to mind. One dreamed up an interview with Seabiscuit, in which the horse disowned his year-younger half-uncle, War Admiral. Life magazine ran a full-page photo layout of Seabiscuit's facial expressions. One bored clocker resorted to timing Smith as he walked down the track, catching him at a clip of 35 minutes for the half-mile. Veteran turf rider John Lardner printed the information, but this, he admitted, had little or no bearing on the race. The New York Press Corps went into a huddle. They dubbed their conflict with Smith the Battle of Long Island. If Smith was going to be silent, so would they. They opted not to write another word about Seabiscuit. It was a bold move, but a bad one. An angry public outcry followed, and the plan was quickly scrapped. So they formed a conspiracy. They banded together to create the Wise Wee Boys, a network of reporters and clockers operating in concert to catch Seabiscuit training. Someone followed Smith every hour of the day, and each reporter received assignments on where and when to be posted. Clockers were stationed at the track 24 hours a day, greeting one another with the phrase, "What do you know?" Sentries were deployed in concentric circles around Barn 43, even reportedly perching in trees. Meetings were held to share information. It was, remembered one reporter, an epic of espionage. The Wise Wee Boys' most inspired decision was to send scouts to pick the brains of anyone who had witnessed Smith's secret training methods in the past. They pooled their findings and made a critical discovery. During his sojourn in the East in 1937, Smith had been caught working Seabiscuit at night 4 times. While this information wouldn't normally have been very useful, the reporters were able to pin down the exact times at which the workouts had been held. In every case, the horse had worked precisely at 8. Further investigation unearthed evidence that Smith had secretly worked Seabiscuit twice at Bay Meadows. Again, the time was 8 p.m. They had found Smith's witching hour. A fearless clocker volunteered to verify the finding. On the night of May 17th, he scaled the grandstand and slid out onto the roof. Shinnying out onto a perilous but hidden spot, he gripped the roof with one hand and his stopwatch with the other. He waited. The track was flooded in moonlight. He could see every pole along the course, glowing in lunar blue. At exactly 8 o'clock, Smith emerged. He walked the length of the grandstand, checking for spies. Seeing no one, he pointed his flashlight at the barns and flicked it on and off twice. Seabiscuit emerged under a rider and cantered up to the far turn. As he dropped into a run, the clocker punched his watch. Seabiscuit rolled around the track, then slowed to a walk and returned to the barn. The clocker stopped his watch and crawled back down. The next morning, papers across the nation ran the workout time, which was slow, and attributed it to Seabiscuit. Not one paper mentioned the circumstances, reporting the work exactly as if the horse had gone out in the standard manner. Smith said nothing. The following afternoon, Smith emerged from the barn to swing Pollard up on a horse for a race. As he stood in the paddock, a reporter's voice sang out from the crowd, "Is it true, Mr. Smith? You consider 8 p.m. to be your lucky hour?" "Tom answered," wrote a delighted Jolly Roger, with a grunt of something akin to rage. There was rejoicing among the Wise Wee Boys. "Score, Newsman 1, Tom Smith 0, trumpeted Jolly Roger in the San Francisco Chronicle. Smith executed a flanking maneuver. A few days later, reporters and clockers were startled to see him leading Seabiscuit out in broad daylight. He was heading toward the training track, which abutted the main track's clubhouse turn. Had Gene Harlow been dancing stark naked around the 16th pole, the press box could not have cleared out any faster. Thinking that Smith was surrendering and victory was at hand, the Wise Wee Boys grabbed their stopwatches and bolted from the booth, ran down through the bowels of the immense building and into the parking lot, piled into their cars, sped over to the training track, bailed out, and sprinted to the side of the course. There they sat, panting and congratulating one another, watching the gap in the track and waiting for Smith to lead Seabiscuit in and lay down his arms, like Lee at Appomattox. Time passed. A breeze whistled over the empty track. Seabiscuit didn't come. The laughter gradually died out. By the time the boys at the training track realized that they had been had, it was all over. Seeing that he had emptied out the clocker stand and reporters' booths, Smith had simply turned Seabiscuit around and worked him over on the main track. He had fooled every single clocker and newsman on the grounds. Knowing he wouldn't be able to pull that off twice, Smith tried his most ingenious move, hiding in plain sight. Since his pursuers were focused on discovering him working Seabiscuit late at night, before dawn, and on the training track, Smith scheduled a workout on the main track in the daytime, just after the last race. He knew that the clockers and reporters would never believe that he would do something so obvious and would pay no attention to him. Because Belmont rules stated that any workout in daylight after the last race had to be approved, Smith had to consult the stewards. He knew better than to walk over to the steward stand. A reporter stood by to tail him wherever he went, so he called the office instead. When the phone rang, the stewards were tied up in meetings. By fantastic coincidence, a reporter named Eddie Farrell happened to have just taken a seat by the phone while he waited to speak with the stewards. Hearing the ringing, a steward yelled into the office, asking Farrell if he would pick up the phone. Farrell answered with a simple hello. "This is trainer Tom Smith speaking," came the voice over the line. "I would like permission to work a horse after the last race." Farrell couldn't believe his ears. He turned in his chair and called to the stewards. "Tom Smith would like permission to work a horse after the last race." "Tell him all right," came the reply. Farrell banged down the phone, dashed to the press box, rounded up the clockers, and delivered the news. 1/2 hour after the last race was run that evening, 22 giggling newsmen and clockers tiptoed to the top of the grandstand. They crammed into the press box and hid themselves, keeping the lights out and spying through peepholes. Grinning and giddy, they watched as Smith's charge worked over 1 mile and 1/8. The following morning, the papers were full of stories on Seabiscuit's workout, but again, the reporters made no mention of the circumstances. "Score, Newsman 2, Tom Smith 0, wrote Jolly Roger. But there was something out of place about the incident. Some of the clockers, training their field glasses on Tom Smith's face as he led the horse back to the barn, noticed a glaring incongruity. Tom Smith looked happy. "I'm wondering," Jolly Roger wrote later, "if that really was Seabiscuit the boys were looking at." It occurred to him for the first time that Grog, who was supposed to be in California, hadn't made an appearance out there in a good long time. The question was still eating at him later as he sat at his spy post outside Smith's cottage. Curious, he trained his field glasses on Smith through the cottage window. There sat the trainer, pushed up against the oil stove. Smith, Roger noted with despair, had a slight knowing smile. Had Smith known he was speaking to a reporter when he called the steward's office that afternoon? "I was just wondering which would be the winner in a contest such as this, an Indian fighter's intuition or that wily old boy coincidence," Roger wrote later. "Personally, I'm coupling Seabiscuit and intuition." At the murky press of daybreak on May 20th, Pollard took Seabiscuit to the track, jogged him around to warm up, then walked him to the training track and into the starting gate. It was immediately clear that Seabiscuit wasn't right. He started banging around the gate like Chance View and refused to settle down. When the bell rang, he left it like a shot. Pollard flattened down for a hard mile workout. The first few furlongs went well, but gradually Seabiscuit began to slow down. After a third quarter in 25 2/5 seconds, Pollard reached back and delivered a crack with the whip. There was no response. The horse kept decelerating. After a final quarter in 27 3/5 seconds, Pollard pulled him up. The stopwatch told the tale. It had taken Seabiscuit 1 minute and 42 seconds to negotiate 8 furlongs on the training track, and that was under strong urging. Worst of all, it was by far the fastest mile a horse had worked since coming to Belmont. The reporters for once had caught the workout. "Somebody ought to tell him he's going to fight War Admiral," one of them mused after watching Seabiscuit slog by. "If he goes into the ring that way against the Admiral, he'll be batted out in a hell of a hurry." The rumors that had been filtering down the backstretch, whispered in confidence between clockers and horsemen, suddenly became noisy public accusations. Something is wrong with Seabiscuit. The newsmen peppered the nation's papers with stories about the slow workouts. People were hollering suspicious questions at Smith everywhere he went. The atmosphere was growing hostile. Smith needed a little Howard image control, but he was on his own. The Howards were on a cruise around Bermuda. They had visited briefly in early May, just before embarking on the ship. Howard, chattering gaily about how he had been mobbed on the train by Seabiscuit fans who were coming to New York for the race, swung by the barn for a quick once-over of his horse.
"He never looked better," said Howard.
"Right," said Smith. Then the Howards had sailed off. They had no idea that a problem had arisen since their departure, or that Smith was in a terrible predicament. The reporters pestered the trainer over and over again. "Is the horse okay?" Seabiscuit, Smith said repeatedly, had never been better. 1 week before the match, Pollard rode out onto the Belmont course for his final test before the match race. He was aboard Fahrenheitis, who was making her first start since she and Pollard went down in the San Carlos 3 months before. In this, the handspring handicap, she was a long shot. No one had thought that Smith could get her back into racing condition after her injuries. Firing her out of the gate, Pollard sent her up alongside the favorite, then drew off to a commanding lead on the backstretch. No one could catch them. Pollard and Fahrenheitis, who might have died together on the track at Santa Anita, cantered home easy winners. Pollard was ready to go. Seabiscuit was not. Smith was shaken. The horse's speed was gone, and Smith didn't know why. The issue was being treated as a scandal. The New York Daily Mirror was demanding that racing officials step in and investigate the horse's condition, and either call off the race or assure the alarmed public that Seabiscuit was in good shape. Even Walter Winchell chimed in, questioning Seabiscuit's fitness. Smith's defenses were less and less convincing. Apparently, in an effort to mollify the inflamed press, he let photographers back into the barn. If the horse was unsound, he said, he would never let him out of his stall to work out. The reporters wanted to see the horse in the daylight. Smith, his nerves at the breaking point, made an ominous statement implying that there would be no match race, then led the horse out. Few seemed to have noticed what Smith had, which was that War Admiral looked even worse than Seabiscuit. On May 17th, it had taken him a doddering 1:49 to negotiate a mile, a time even slower than Seabiscuit's. 4 days later, it took him 2:08 1/5, trotting horse time, to run the race distance of 1.25 miles. On May 23rd, he had seemed so uncharacteristically narcotized in starting gate drills that a bystander had remarked, "You'd swear he was a dull-witted lead pony instead of the high-strung animal he is." By many reports, Riddle and Conway were weighing whether or not to scratch their horse from the race, but they were waiting in hopes that Seabiscuit would be withdrawn first, saving them from being blamed for the massive disappointment. Smith was getting conflicting signals. Some people were telling him to stay in the race, that War Admiral was training so badly that Seabiscuit, bad form and all, could lick him. Others warned Smith that War Admiral's bad works may have been designed to fool Smith about the colt's condition. He didn't know what to do, and the reporters wouldn't stop pressuring him. Was the horse lame? No. Was he not in shape? If the horse is not in shape, I'll pull him out of there. Was he sick? He galloped yesterday. Sick horses don't gallop. They act sick. It was time to make a decision, but the Howards were hundreds of miles away. Smith patched through an emergency call to their cruise ship. Come to Belmont. The Howards couldn't believe the state in which they found Belmont. Wild accusations were flying around, including one published charge that Smith was deliberately working the horse slowly in order to get long odds in the race. Everyone wanted to know if the horse would run. Howard was privately distressed, but publicly reassuring and confident. To quiet the doubters, he gave his word that the public would be able to see Seabiscuit work a full 10 furlongs, the race distance, at 3:30 on the afternoon of May 24th. On the morning of the appointed day, Smith took Seabiscuit to the track for a short morning gallop, in preparation for the afternoon's public workout. He studied his horse's action, his eyes fixed on the horse's knees. There it was, a faint whisper of soreness. It was subtle, but it was there. Howard had a terrible decision to make. Seabiscuit probably could run in the race. At best, he would probably lose. At worst, He could be injured. Howard's inclination was to scratch him, but the potential consequences were daunting. Belmont officials, anticipating the largest crowd ever to attend a horse race in America, had worked themselves to exhaustion and spent $30,000 to publicize the race and prepare the track. In the Belmont grandstand, which, if stood on end, would nearly equal the height of the new Empire State Building, every seat was booked. Millions had been wagered. Silversmiths had already cast an elaborate trophy. Press coverage was at saturation levels. The build-up to the Memorial Day Indy 500, normally a huge sporting event, was all but squeezed out of the nation's press. In the San Francisco Chronicle, coverage of the auto race was buried on page 24, alongside an interpretation of the tides. The horses were on the cover of Newsweek, as well as the ubiquitous radio guide, which showed War Admiral galloping, Seabiscuit yawning. Billboards advertising the event rimmed every major road on Long Island. CBS Radio had taken out full-page ads to promote its international broadcast of the race. Several Seabiscuit Limited trains, packed to the doors, were already en route from the West Coast. Other chartered trains were coming from Kentucky, Chicago, Boston, and Philadelphia. Bing Crosby had booked a plane east with a huge party of his friends. Swope, Widener, and Whitney had gone out on a narrow limb to give Howard what he had demanded, putting up an enormous purse and postponing the Suburban Handicap, a fixture of the biggest racing day of the spring, to accommodate the race. There was even talk of shipping Old Man-O-War all the way from Kentucky to accompany his son and grandson to the post. The world awaited the race with rapt attention. And should Howard decide to scratch the horse, he knew that it would only confirm the long-standing belief that his horse was a cripple. "Now the one time out of so many times that the critics appear to be right," Howard said bitterly, "has to come just before a race like this." Hours before Seabiscuit was to undertake his public workout, Howard and Smith retreated to the cottage by the barn. Nearby, the groom stood with the horse they called Old Pop, grim-faced, watching the door and saying nothing. Seabiscuit, oblivious, rooted around in his hay. A passerby finally broke the silence.
"He looks all right."
"Yeah, he looks all right," replied a groom. "But he hasn't been working very well, has he?"
"No, he hasn't."
In mid-afternoon, the cottage door opened. Smith emerged, went to Seabiscuit's stall, and began preparing to send the horse out. Howard went to the steward's stand, to which he called C.V. Whitney, Joseph Widener, and Herbert Bayard Swope. At the track, crowds began to gather to see the workout. Smith led Seabiscuit toward the course. Howard disappeared into the administrative offices to explain the problem to Swope and Whitney and get their opinion. A few minutes later, he walked out. A crush of reporters pushed up to him. His voice wavered as he began to speak. It was 3:30. Back on the track, Smith boosted Pollard up on Seabiscuit, swung his leg over Pumpkin's back, and began moving down the course. The track announcer's voice cut over the grandstand. The race was off. The crowd sagged. Smith led Seabiscuit past the stunned fans and back into the barn. At the steward's office, Howard gave his profound apologies to everyone, then took Marcella back to their lodgings at the Garden City Hotel. She wanted to cry in private. Howard was mortified over the disaster he had created, and he was worried about his horse.
"I don't know if he'll ever come out of his soreness," he said.
"We won't patch him up and send him out there to break his heart trying to win." The idea of retiring him and taking him home to Ridgewood began playing in his mind. Smith shook his head. The horse was not through yet. Smith could work through the lameness. Howard came to believe him. They began laying plans. Howard was in a fix. His efforts to arrange a match at Belmont had not only fallen through, they had greatly diminished his chances of ever securing a meeting between the two horses. Riddle, who had never been more than lukewarm about it, could now say that he had tried to get the match race, but that Howard had backed out. War Admiral could go into his scheduled retirement at season's end without anyone accusing him of dodging the best competition. Belmont officials were snakebit. Howard did his best to warm them to the idea of rescheduling the match, even setting aside his heretofore paramount goal of breaking Sunbow's earnings mark. "Forget the $100,000 purse," he said. Once Seabiscuit recovered, he would welcome a race at Belmont held merely on a sporting basis. Belmont officials grudgingly agreed to consider it, and there was talk of rescheduling the race for the fall meeting. Riddle put an end to that. Belmont officials, trying to come up with some way to salvage the weekend, telephoned Riddle and offered War Admiral a berth in the Suburban Handicap, which had been moved to Saturday, May 28th, to accommodate the match. Though War Admiral had been assigned £132, Riddle accepted. The day appeared to have been saved. 25,000 fans, many of whom had crossed the country expecting to see the race of the century, mobbed Belmont on race day. The papers were singing of Riddle's sportsmanship and starting War Admiral in the race. The crowd, which had greeted Howard's announcement with sympathy and understanding, was eager to see its consolation prize. At the very last second, without any warning, Riddle and Conway refused to start War Admiral. They offered no explanation. Officials insisted that they give one, so they cited poor track condition. As the track was, by all accounts, perfect, the Suburban was run in record time. No one believed them. War Admiral's scratch appeared on the jockey board in the infield. Most of the reporters, and much of the crowd, believed that Riddle had simply balked at the 132-pound impost and didn't care enough about the consequences of scratching to do the sportsmanlike thing. The crowd had run out of patience. A cacophony of boos and catcalls rolled down the grandstand for a full 2 minutes. Riddle, wrote one spectator, was accused of everything under the sun, save the shooting of Lincoln and the current recession. C.V. Whitney listened to the din and was livid. Asked if he would agree to a War Admiral Seabiscuit rescheduling, he snapped. "Not if I could buy them for a dime a dozen. I'll never again consent to such a thing." After seeing what Belmont had gone through, no other track managers were likely to agree to a race either. There was a rumor that Seabiscuit's lameness was a ruse designed to avoid a loss to War Admiral, and an awful lot of people believed it. Howard had, it seemed, only one chance left. If no one was willing to arrange a match, he was going to have to follow War Admiral to his next scheduled contest, to pit Seabiscuit against him in a full field race. The next suitable venue was the Massachusetts Handicap on June 29th. War Admiral was slated to run in it, and though Suffolk Downs officials made no effort to invite defending champion Seabiscuit, Howard had already entered him. Seabiscuit would have a full month to recover. Ample time, said Smith, for him to work the soreness out of those knees. Perhaps Riddle felt the sting of his public excoriation. On June 6th, he ran his colt in Aqueduct's Queens County Handicap, despite a 132-pound impost. Many of the fans, eager to let Riddle know how they felt about the scratching of a week before, attempted to drown out any cheering with lusty howls. In spite of the mixed reception, War Admiral won. Then he loaded up and headed north to Suffolk Downs to prepare for the Massachusetts Handicap. On June 14th, Smith and the Howards followed him. Pollard and his agent, Yummy, came with them. Wolf stayed behind. With Pollard in perfect condition, he thought they didn't need him. Chapter 15 Fortune's Fool. It was the early morning of June 23rd, 1938. Workout hours. At Boston's Suffolk Downs, horses skittered and blew over the track, slower ones making lazy loops around the oval, faster ones humming down the rail. In the clocker stand, men clicked stopwatches and jotted down numbers. There was a pause, and all eyes refocused up the track. Around the turn came a long man on a low horse. The man was Red Pollard. The horse was Seabiscuit. The great rolling wheel of Red's life had swung upward again, and he could not suppress his high spirits. He was riding in fine form, everything clicking, the broken bones mended, his timing right. Beneath him that morning was Seabiscuit, and Pollard could feel from the tension in the reins and the rhythm under him that Smith had worked his magic. The horse was, as they said, sound as a Roosevelt dollar, and jumping out of his skin to run. He clicked past the track poles at a staccato pace, Pollard tipped back in the irons, and Seabiscuit tugged on his hands, picking off 6 furlongs in 1:12 1/5 seconds. Marvelous time. The horse finished the mile sparkling and galloped out 1/8 of a mile farther, still burning Pollard's arms and his eagerness to continue. A smile shimmered over Smith's face. 6 days to go until the Massachusetts handicap. Bring on War Admiral. Back at the barn, Pollard jumped off and handed the reins to her groom. He sat down in front of a shed row to rest and chat with friends. While sitting there, he caught sight of an old friend from his Tijuana days, owner Bert Bloom, and the two began talking. Bloom was in trouble. A rider had promised to gallop a green 2-year-old named Modern Youth for him, but hadn't shown up. There were no other riders available. The workout was critical. The colt was scheduled to race and needed a blowout. The race in question was a forgettable weekday event for a trifling purse, but Bloom was strapped for money. Pollard, Bloom remembered later, had been broke often enough to know what it was like. And he had not forgotten a good turn Bloom had done him back in his Bush League days. "I'll work the bum," Pollard said. He hopped aboard the horse and trotted off. Had the rider given Bloom a moment to consider the risk Pollard was taking in riding an immature colt just before a major race, Bloom would not have let him go. But Pollard, as Bloom noted, was impulsive with his generosity. He and Modern Youth were gone in an instant. All Bloom could do was watch. Flying past the 3/8 pole at breakneck speed, Modern Youth suddenly spooked, bolting to the right, and headed straight for the outer rail. Pollard couldn't stop him. The colt plunged through the rail, somehow got his hooves back under him again, and fled for the barns. Pollard clung to his back, unable to regain control. The horse was running in a blind terror, streaking down the shed rows. He was probably doing 30 or so when he tried to cut between 2 barns. He was moving too fast to make it. He skidded sideways and slammed into the corner of a barn, then fell in a heap. A sickening noise ran down the long line of barns. It was Pollard. He was screaming. His right leg was nearly sheared off below the knee. All along the backstretch, men dropped what they were doing and ran toward the sound. They found Pollard lying on the ground, writhing spastically. The flesh of his leg had been ripped away, exposing the bone. Pollard's face was a rictus of agony, his lips peeled back over his teeth, and gusts of pain were rolling through his body and escaping through his mouth in deep, guttural roars. Someone ran for an ambulance, but the one that sat at the track during the day's races had not yet arrived. Someone else called Smith, who rang for an ambulance and then sped toward the barns. The stable hands, despairing of getting help to the track fast enough, fetched the only transportation on hand, a little runabout truck that the track starter used to motor around the course. The truck had no passenger seat, and the back was cluttered with gate equipment. So while Pollard lay on the ground, his cries distilling down to long strings of barked obscenities, the panicked stable hands heaved the gear out of the runabout. They sprinted down the shed rows, gathering pommel pads, horse blankets, and rub rags, and threw them on the truck bed to serve as a makeshift gurney mattress. They hoisted the screaming rider up from the foot of the barn wall and gently laid him on the horse paraphernalia. The starter jumped into the driver's seat while a host of stable hands climbed in around Pollard, who was swearing out every oath in his tremendous vocabulary. The little runabout chugged off onto the road. Back at the barn, Bloom was in tears. He sobbed uncontrollably for an hour and sank into a week-long, guilt-inspired bender. He never forgave himself. Though Winthrop Hospital was only 5 minutes from the track, none of the stable hands knew where it was. The runabout driver steered the truck blindly through the streets, slowed by heavy traffic, trying to find someone to help Pollard. The jockey never stopped screaming. An excruciating 45 minutes passed. Pollard was growing more and more frantic. Then, across lanes of traffic ahead, someone spotted a physician's bungalow. The runabout puttered toward it. Just then, an ambulance screamed up behind the starter's truck and pulled to a halt. Smith sprang out. After commandeering the ambulance at the track, he had been combing the streets for nearly an hour in search of the runabout. He found Pollard mad with pain, hotter than a smoking 45, went one account, and not holding back. They transferred their wailing patient into the ambulance. Smith climbed in beside him, and the driver hit the siren and slammed the pedal to the floor, darting in and out of lanes and swerving around cars. Along a road running perpendicular to a river, the traffic thickened, bogging the ambulance down. Pollard became wild, screeching and howling in the back.
"Tom," he shouted, "stop this wagon. I can't stand it any longer. Stop it, I tell you."
His voice was so loud that passers-by across the river turned to see what the commotion was. Smith, shaken by Pollard's insistence, told the driver to stop. Pollard sat up and began searching the lines of buildings. His eyes hit on one.
"Stop!" he bellowed. "That's the place!"
He pointed to a liquor store.
"Tom, I tell you I cannot get to that hospital alive if you don't get on over there and buy me a bottle of beer."
Smith, a lifelong teetotaler who strongly disapproved of Pollard's drinking, probably waved off the jockey's plaintive wails for alcohol that morning. But his agent, Yummy, came through. Speeding to the hospital, he snuck a crock of Bow Wow wine into Pollard. He found the stricken rider distracting himself from his pain by firing off aphorisms from Ralph Waldo Emerson, Old Waldo, at the nurses. Yummy saw Pollard's leg and was horrified. Both bones of his lower leg were splintered. Yummy knew what the injuries meant. He reeled over by the telephones and wept. He spent the morning calling Pollard's friends, crying into the phone as he broke the news. "The cougar just got throwed off a horse he was working and busted his leg," he sobbed to David Alexander. Yummy stayed by Pollard all day, despondent, greeting the worried friends who came to see him. He would still be there long after nightfall. Someone contacted San Francisco and told the Howards what had happened. Howard got on the telephone and pulled every string he had. Almost immediately, he had a team of the nation's best orthopedic specialists on planes flying in to Boston at his expense. They examined Pollard's leg. Somehow they saved it from amputation. But it was a hollow victory. Pollard, they announced, would probably never walk again. His career was declared over. Smith wired the news to Wolf in New York, asking that he come up immediately. Wolf sped north. Pollard stabilized. Wolf arrived to take his place on Seabiscuit. On the backstretch, there was only one reminder of the accident. At 6 o'clock one morning, shortly after Pollard went down, a fully equipped ambulance rolled onto the racecourse, pulled over to the side, and parked. Suffolk Downs made sure that it would be there every morning from that day forward. No fallen rider, at least at Suffolk Downs, would have to go to the hospital in a starter's runabout again. At the Howard barn, life had to go on. Smith prepared Kayak, the horse Lynn Howard had bought in Argentina and sold to his father, for a purse race at Suffolk. As soon as the colt had disembarked in California, Smith had sent him to the Burlingame Polo Grounds near the Howards' house. He had put the best man he knew, his own son Jimmy, in charge of his breaking and early training. The son had clearly inherited his father's instincts. Returned to the elder Smith once he matured, Kayak showed promise. A very difficult horse upon his arrival, he was now as tame as a kitten. In his first start, at New York's Aqueduct Racecourse under Pollard on June 10th, he had led into the stretch and lost narrowly, finishing second. Smith was starting to think that Kayak was going to be awfully good. Seabiscuit took well to Wolf's guidance. His workouts for the Massachusetts handicap were brilliant. All traces of knee soreness were gone, and his action was smoother than ever. Smith sent him out one morning for a 3-furlong workout. He lined Seabiscuit up at the 3/8 pole, positioned a sprinting stablemate 50 yards ahead, and set them off at the same time. Seabiscuit mowed his stablemate down with incredible speed, running the first 1/8 in 11 seconds, a 1/4 in 23, and 3/8 in 36. "If that isn't running," Smith later said, "I don't know anything about horses." War Admiral, meanwhile, was his usual combative self. Guarded by Spot, a surly Dalmatian who took hunks of flesh out of reporters who got too close, he stormed around the barn and fretted, pouted, and balked in his workouts. At times, he refused to run without a workmate. One day, he backed himself up against a fence and froze there, hardtack style, simply refusing to budge. His handlers scurried around, trying to coax him into moving. In the end, the only way Conway was able to get him to move at all was to turn him the wrong way around the track. On June 26th, Smith was set to give Seabiscuit his last pre-race workout. Outside was a driving rain. Charles and Marcella were due in that afternoon, so Smith delayed the workout. The rain fell all day. At 4:30, the Howards arrived. The track was a quagmire. Howard and Smith stepped out into the muck and worried. In normal conditions, they wouldn't have worked the horse, but Seabiscuit couldn't afford to miss another workout before meeting War Admiral. Smith led the horse out. Seabiscuit flew through the slop to clock 6 furlongs in 1:12 2/5 seconds. Howard beamed. On June 28th, the day before the race, heavy rain was still raking the course. Entries were due by 10:30 a.m. At 9:30, War Admiral's entry was made. Conway was confident. "He can beat anything on 4 feet," he had told reporters upon arriving at Suffolk with the bucking, rearing War Admiral in hand. "And if anything beats him, we will know the miracle of the ages has happened." Seabiscuit, he said, was just one more horse to beat. Still, Howard and Smith waited. The rain never let up. Smith went down to the track office with his entry, but just stood there without entering the horse, watching the rain. Finally, just 14 minutes before entries closed, he made the entry. The decision was not final. They could still scratch him at any point up to 45 minutes before post time. "We're still on the fence," said Howard. "If the track stayed loose and wet, the horse was in. If the rain stopped and the track turned into the kind of thick surface that would pull on Seabiscuit's legs, he was out." Smith went back to the barn and readied Kayak for his purse race. The horse was superb, skipping over the mud to win. His time was excellent. That night, David Alexander and a host of radio technicians arrived at Pollard's hospital room. NBC had asked Alexander to host a nationally aired live interview with Wolf and Pollard, conducted from Pollard's hospital room. Wolf would be on a hookup from a Boston broadcasting studio. Alexander found Pollard lying supine with his leg up in traction, his misery greatly assuaged by a leggy private nurse named Agnes. The technician set up a makeshift radio studio around his bed. Concerned that Pollard's famously mischievous ad-libs might get them kicked off the air, Alexander had come prepared. He presented Pollard with a complete script for the interview, leaving nothing to the jockey's rich imagination or questionable vocabulary. At the studio, Wolf was given the same script. At first, the interview went as planned. Wolf read his lines and Pollard read his responses. When they reached the section devoted to race tactics, Wolf dutifully recited his line, asking Pollard how he should ride the race. Just then, Pollard's script spilled to the floor. The pages fluttered everywhere. Alexander hurriedly tried to gather them up. He looked up, a mess of papers in hand, just as Pollard opened his mouth. In the jockey's eyes, Alexander saw an evil gleam. "Why, Georgie boy," said Pollard to the eager ears of the entire nation, "get on the horse, face to the front, put one leg on each side of him, get someone to lead you into the gate, and then fuck it up like you usually do." For a moment, the only sound reaching the NBC radio audience was a brief swish as the radio technicians lunged for their controls. Wolf collapsed into peals of laughter. Alexander forged on with the interview, but the discussion he had planned so carefully had broken down completely. Wolf couldn't stop laughing and was barely able to grunt out his responses. NBC didn't think it was so funny. The quip was a national scandal. The network, horrified at Pollard, wrote up a sanitized transcript of the interview. The Harrows worked the track all night. Howard kept the reporters up late. He was careful not to raise expectations. "My horse is sharper than a fishwife's tongue, and I'm as anxious as the next man to see him race against War Admiral. But a holding track definitely is against him, and if we have to miss Mr. Riddle's horse today, we'll catch up with him yet." In the morning, the rain stopped. Seabiscuit was taken to the track for a final blowout. He ran beautifully. Smith took him back to the stall, inspected his legs, found them clean and cool, and bound them up in bandages for the rest of the morning. As midday rolled past, 70,000 fans spilled out of the hotels and special trains and poured into the track. It was the second largest crowd ever to attend a horse race in North America. Among the fans was Samuel Riddle. It had taken a special effort to get him to the track that afternoon. He was in poor health and had to come with the assistance of his physician, who sat with him. Howard and Smith went out to make their final decision. They walked down the track from the finish line to the far turn. Their feet sank to the ankles, but the mud was loose. They looked for the cupping that told of a sticky track, but they didn't find it. 1 hour before post time, 15 minutes before the deadline for scratches, they decided to go. Seabiscuit's number blinked up on the board. The race was on. Smith had never been more confident in his horse. Not normally a betting man, he cleaned out his pockets and put it all on Seabiscuit's nose. 40 minutes before post time, Smith walked into Seabiscuit's stall. The bandages were unraveled from the horse's legs. Smith slid his hands over the horse's joints and tendons, feeling for the uniform, cool firmness of a healthy leg. Halfway down one foreleg, his fingers tracing the bones and soft tissues of the lower leg, Smith paused. Seabiscuit was flinching. Smith looked hard at the spot. There was no break in the skin, and the hair lay flat. He touched it again. He felt a slender vein of heat running from the ankle to the knee. The leg was injured. Smith realized that the horse must have kicked himself while galloping that morning. Because the skin had not been nicked and the heat had been slow to settle in, Smith had missed it. He could not race this horse. But the trainer was too late. The deadline for scratches had passed 5 minutes before. Already the other horses, War Admiral included, were trickling to the paddock. Smith would have to appeal to the stewards for special permission to withdraw his horse. Clutching a scratch form, he left Seabiscuit in his stall and ran for the steward stand. He had to cut through the crowd to reach it, and the throng was packed in and tamped down. Minutes slipped by as Smith waded through the mass of spectators. Finally, he made it to the ladder that led to the steward stand, suspended from the grandstand roof. He cleared the ladder and burst into the room. Seabiscuit, he announced, was injured and could not run. The steward stared at him, incredulous. No one moved. Smith realized that they didn't believe him. Smith's hijinks with the press and Seabiscuit's recent history of scratches had come back to haunt him. The stewards had probably heard rumors that Seabiscuit had not really been lame at Belmont, and they were determined not to be duped. Every one of them believed that Smith had simply decided to duck War Admiral and was using injury as an excuse. Chief Steward Tom Thorpe demanded that Smith run his horse. Smith refused. They traded charges and countercharges. A crowd of reporters gathered outside the room, looking in the windows. They could see Smith and the stewards making angry gestures at each other, but they couldn't make out the words. Finally, Smith walked around the room, holding the scratch form straight out in front of him, offering it to each steward in turn. Each one glared back at him and refused to take it. Furious, Smith shredded up the form and stormed out. No one, he snapped, was going to force him to race an injured horse. The steward sat there and mulled over what to do. Outside, the crowd sensed that something was up. Every horse but Seabiscuit was in the paddock. A few people began to boo. Howard was brought in. The stewards wanted him to overrule his trainer. Howard knew that another scratching would bring down an avalanche of criticism, but he would not second-guess Smith. He proposed a compromise. Bring in the track veterinarians to decide.